is Cole Kublik?
No idea.
This could be trouble.
Now with the call, Cole Kublik.
Auburn.
We just talked to Cole Kublik a little while ago.
You watch him now on the screen.
It's bad ball. It's bad football.
That was Jim Bellett, number 61.
I get.
Speak up, please.
Get you some of that, Jalen Tabor.
Is that good enough for you?
I'm almost embarrassed.
You can be miserable, but they are going to be miserable with you.
I said what I said.
We have to score.
What an exciting time in America.
And here he is, having the time of his life.
Don't clap. That could be tough. Don't clap.
Show Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Ump, live from the Southern RV Wholesale Studios. Go to srvwholesale.com today. Fifth wheels, travel trailers, toy haulers, and more. You can finance on site. You can trade yours in. You can rent at Southern RV Wholesale. Go to srvwholesale.com. Appreciate Mike Griffith of sccountry.com with us, telling us that Jimbo Fisher is now staring down or in sight for the Tennessee Volunteers and John Curry. Some people are pointing out via Twitter that Jimbo has this $40 million buyout, which I think is accurate. But again, like we stated, if there's a mutual desire to get out by both parties, then you can figure that out. 866-485-9867 if you'd like to get in. 866-485-WUMP if you want to if you want to get in and talk anything college football related. We didn't get to Alabama, Mississippi State, and just sort of the X's and O's of what I saw in this game and how this game took place. I was really impressed with the Mississippi State defensive line. I thought Jeffrey Simmons had a good game. I thought up front they did enough to sort of disrupt and cause some problems with that Alabama offensive line. A lot of slants, a lot of stunts. They played high risk, and this is kind of who I thought they should be and would be going into the season, and it worked. And I thought when Alabama hit some big plays against them, they weren't high risk. Now, that's not through the air. It's more so in the run game because you saw the blitz sort of backfire against them late in the game. But I thought when Mississippi State was moving, I thought when they were attacking up front, especially against the run, they had a lot of success, and Alabama's offensive line struggled. And I would expect to see that more this week against Mercer, who runs a very weird three-man front. It's kind of difficult to handle. Don't be surprised if this defensive front doesn't give Alabama some headaches early. But I would expect Kevin Steele to install some things that has his D-line moving a lot. They're not going to sit back and wait. They're not going to sit back and read this Alabama offensive line. They'll go after him. And I think they have a chance to cause some problems. I thought up front for Mississippi State, Braxton Hoyt also had a really nice game, 95. He's a Pelham native, so this game, of course, you would think meant a lot to him. But kind of intriguing to just see what that State defense was able to do offensively. I'm a little frustrated with the people who are just immediately saying that J.C. Hasenauer is no good, and that J.C. Hasenauer is a bad player, and he's the weak link of the offensive line. Now, let's just start off by saying this. He's not a starter, and he's not a starter for a reason, okay? He's a second-team player. But I think Alabama fans are – I don't want to say fans. I'm not going to say fans because most of them have complaints about him. Alabama's fortunate to have a guy like J.C. Hasenauer to be able to plug in. I mean, look what Tennessee is doing right now. Tennessee is playing a redshirt freshman who's never been in a game at guard. Tennessee is playing a converted tight end in the spring at tackle that's never played a game of tackle in his life, ever. Never played tackle in his life. He's starting at tackle in the SEC. You got a guy that's been in big games, has big game experience, has played against Power 5 opponents, played center and guard, understands the position, understands the system, and he's able to go in and play. Did he give up a couple pressures and a sack? Yes. He got beaten past pro a few times, but I thought he handled himself well in the run game, and I thought all in all he performed well enough for Alabama to win. He showed some rust. He got in the game, and he hadn't seen game action like that in a while. And it took him a few series to get back to what he needed to be, but I didn't think he played bad by any stretch of the imagination. And I think Alabama's fortunate to have a guy with that kind of experience to be able to plug and go when you lose a starting offensive lineman. Not a lot of schools have that. Not a lot of schools can bank on that. So I thought that was something that needed to be pointed out. Let's go to the phones now. Welcome in B-Rich to the show. Good morning, B-Rich. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Arky, as well.
Hey, Arky.
I'm kind of glad to hear you. Before I get to Mike Griffith, I'm kind of glad to hear you touching on Hassenauer because, personally, from what I saw, I thought he played outstanding. Like you said, given his lack of repetitions this season, and I don't think he played any worse than Pierce Baker has all year. And I think that's pretty outstanding given the lack of playing time. I had a guy that we know tell me when Ross Pierce Baker came in to the program that he was Barrett Jones 2.0. And if just in my opinion, I don't think Ross Pierce Baker is very physical. I don't think he's been very, you know, lived up to the hype. I think Hassenauer plays nastier than Pierce Baker does. I think he's more physical. I don't think he's as physically talented, but I think he plays with a meaner mentality, which I like to see. But I'll leave the offensive line breakdown to you. A couple of things that just continue to blow my mind from Mike. To hear him compare the Butch Jones firing to the Philip Fulmer firing is just completely ludicrous. Check the resumes there, Mike. Philip Fulmer had pretty much brought Tennessee to the highest point that you can. And to compare that firing, I remember both of them very clearly. And even though firings go bad, Fulmer's with nothing like this. And the most egregious thing to hear him say was that not winning the SEC or the SEC East, so what, who cares, in a garbage SEC East right now, it's a good team like Florida has pretty much just run it. I mean, it's been wide open for Butch Jones to just run the SEC East, and he couldn't get it done. So to say it doesn't mean anything to win a bad SEC East year after year, or at least half of the year tenure, is ludicrous. So, I know that he's kind of the shock guest that you guys have on and all that, but Mike just lives in a fantasy world, and he's like that annoying telemarketer that just keeps calling you back, and you request to have your number taken off the list, and he just keeps calling back.
Great stuff, B. Rich. Appreciate the call.
You know, I did think it was interesting to hear that if according to Mike, Tennessee had beaten Vanderbilt and been the SEC number two team to go to the Sugar Bowl instead of Auburn, they'd have gotten an extension. It's weird to think that if they had won that Vanderbilt game,
that they would have been in the Sugar Bowl?
Yeah, it's weird. It was a really bad year for the SEC last
year. By the way,
year.
I'll say this. I feel like that team would have matched up against Oklahoma a lot better than Auburn's team did last year.
Yeah, I probably would agree with you.
Alvin Kamara, Josh Dobbs, Derek Barnett.
Well, listen, Auburn was playing a broken Sean White. You know, they
who became more broken
like
in the game.
Like immediately in the game. As soon as the game started, it's like, yep, there was my left.
He was broken going in, and then he became almost fully broken in game. So, yeah, they didn't.
You know what? It's strange. Since Georgia had their last run with Mark Richt, let's just say, since Alabama has come in and dominated, and since Florida has left the Urban Meyer era, it is strange to me that in the SEC, since, what was it, 2009 is last year?
Mark Richt's?
No. Urban Meyer's is last year, Florida. Basically since the beginning of this decade. The team that's kind of been the one that's gone to multiple SEC championships, took advantage of it, oddly enough, was South Carolina. They're the ones that went back-to-back-to-back 11-win seasons and went to the SEC championship game. Oddly enough, they took advantage of these. Now, they didn't get to Atlanta as much as possible, but Georgia never took full advantage to be able to dominate during that time. Florida clearly didn't. I mean, since the last couple of years, Florida has been there.
But couldn't we say
Tennessee didn't take
advantage. Couldn't we say this about so many coaches and their tenure in maybe one game? What if Mark Richt beats Alabama in the SEC championship game with Aaron Murray? And they go play a now what's viewed as not an extremely strong Notre Dame team for the national title. Good chance they get a national title.
What I'm saying is that no one, there's been no one team that went up in the East and took the banner. Like it has been a mishmash of South Carolina and Florida getting there, and it's not been. Georgia had the perfect opportunity since Urban Meyer left to make a run. South Carolina had a good Tennessee had a good opportunity with a relatively down East to take the run, to take the reins and run with it.
Since Tennessee's been in it in 07, three SEC East teams have been to multiple SEC championship games. Florida, Georgia, and Missouri.
Yeah, Missouri, another one of those teams that Missouri's been there a couple, but Tennessee couldn't get back to it. Like it feels like that there was like a decade, again, go back since we were talking, that it's kind of lost for the SEC East as far as Tennessee is concerned. Where, listen, Georgia had a couple of really good years. And South Carolina arguably could have won a couple of those games and Tennessee could have been there at the end. It feels like one of the more frustrating parts as a Tennessee fan is to watch the SEC East not be that great since 2010 and you still couldn't take advantage.
Yeah, but I'm not going to sit here also and act like just because a coach would have been given an extension that means that coach couldn't then be fired.
No. That
makes it a little more complicated, a little more difficult, and obviously makes it more expensive. But the end-all, be-all of getting rid of a coach is not whether or not he had been extended in the previous year.
No. This has nothing to do with it. It's just there's got to be a frustration factor that adds on to it, that if he had found himself in the SEC championship game once, maybe we're knocking a little bit different. Like maybe if he had even gotten to Atlanta, rematched against Alabama and lost again, or had gotten there against Auburn.
I just think what this team has become and what it is right now, and I think there's a lot more to be made about things that are happening off the field than we're discussing with Butch Jones. I think there are a lot of things that are being questioned and that we don't really have a lot of details on that probably helped ease this decision for John Curry and made it much more acceptable and a much easier pill for him to swallow to be able to say, we got to do this now. And we got to start looking for the future. So let's get the 10 after tweets brought to you by First Family Mortgage. Go to 1FMC.com.
Bring me the tweets!
You can tweet into the show, at Cube Show. Best way to be a part. Dan Strickland tweets in at Cube Show, quote, Griff, that's all well and good, but what will happen to the turnover trash can? Will it be adopted or taken into foster care by the turnover chain?
Apparently, turnover daddy. That's what it is. You're going to be adopted by him. Sure. Foster care.
I feel like the turnover chain could easily handle that.
Moon Pie tweets, how can Mike Griffin now even admit Butch needed to be fired? Could you hear the pain in his voice trying to dodge the question?
I don't hear pain.
Bama B. Rich says, wow, to hear at Mike Griffith talk, Mizzou's defense must be top five nationally.
I agreed with the part of that statement as far as not playing Garantano with that offensive line. I don't care who the defense is. Outside of Trey Smith, there's not a lot of guys who have played quality reps on that offensive line. Jayshon Robertson, a few, but you're starting two freshmen and then lost another starter that put three freshmen into the game, not including Trey Smith, which then gave you four freshmen.
Quality reps don't matter, Tennessee. Leadership reps do. Bama Dan tweets, Griff, now that you've been released from captivity and don't have to defend Butch anymore, will there be a book tour marketing your bravery? Interesting question. Wish we had time to get to that. We were a little pushed up against the break there. We could have asked him that. Red Ass Cole tweets, David Shula? You share the same name, Mike. Get your Shulas right.
No, David.
Hashtag Mike Griffin. This tweet. Oh, man. Just not a lot of people in love with Mike right now.
No.
That's fine.
I like that Carmen Cook tweets, weird, only Mike Griffith seems to be saying that he is not a good guest. Do you even listen to the show?
He's a great guest.
Tommy Mays tweets in, at Cube Show, at Bama Be Rich, maybe, but one thing Butch isn't that Fuller is a rat. I think he meant Fulmer.
No, Fuller is what the stadium is now that they don't have to empty it anymore. Greg Bacon tweets, they low down. They dirty. They some snitches. Here we go, Cole. Here's something not Mike Griffith related. Cole, is there anything that you've seen that Alabama can do from a scheme standpoint to help with their lack of linebacker depth? That D looked rough. That's what she said.
You really think it looked rough?
Not me.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, yeah, I do think it looked rough during that game. I think, look, listen, there were
330 total yards for Mississippi State. 330 total yards.
But that's because Mississippi State was slow and methodical with their offense. They dominated that game up until the fourth quarter. And I know the fourth quarter technically counts.
It is part of the game.
They will count that in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
But they weren't trying to go up-tempo fast to annihilate Alabama with yards and plays. They were doing what I like to call the Dallas Cowboy way. Hey, this tweet comes from Brandon Willis, who said, you should trust Mike Griffith as much as a 90-year-old should trust a fart.
Matt Hallam said, at Swain event, pretty sure Griff just referenced you on that Cube show.
What we're talking about. Jared Sill, Eddie_Beast, maybe a first-time tweeter to the show. I don't recognize the name. A week ago, we were talking about two SEC teams in the playoff. Now, what if Miami wins out but loses to Clemson in the ACC championship game?
There's so many of these guys.
They got to let them in. Hashtag.
First off, they don't have to let anybody in.
Hashtag.
Turnover chain. Turnover chain. Turnover chain.
Ross Twing tweets in a photograph of Mark Ingram after Sunday's game and says, at Cube Show, Mark Ingram is supportive of the, quote, turnover train at his post-game presser.
Turnover train. Turnover train. Turnover train. Turnover train.
It's hard to stop a turnover train. That's what I've read on the internet.
Somebody should remix Come On Ride That Train to Come On Ride That Chain. In reference to the turnover chain, and just redo that thing. Get it blowing up again.
It's been a while since we had to blow up. We need to reintroduce that into the wild.
Hey, speaking of that turnover trash can, I thought this was a funny story. So Missouri had a touchdown trash can at the beginning of the season. And when they scored, they would go dunk the balls in the trash can. And apparently they wore it out. Like they broke it.
Like in game one, I'm assuming. Because they had like 70 touchdown passes.
Had a lot.
From Drew Locke, so.
Just thought it was interesting that they used to have one. No, they don't.
Well, you know what why Tennessee still has their turnover trash can? They haven't worn it out. Haven't caused enough turnovers.
Hmm. Fair enough. All right, when we come back, James Spady, Alabama A&M head football coach, joins us. Welcome back in, Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Yump. A tough loss over the weekend to Jackson State, 10-7, for the Alabama A&M Bulldogs. To join us now and recap, we've got James Spady, head coach of the Alabama A&M Bulldogs. Coach, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Cube. I'm doing good. I'm doing good considering.
Do you do anything different with your team when you're frustrated and things maybe not going your way? We always hear about, you know, players only meetings or team meetings or position meetings or changing things up. What do you try to do to sort of change the attitude or mindset of your club?
I mean, you probably try all of that at some point or another, and I know we have. But at the end of the day, and you know, I'm the head ball coach, so at the end of the day, it all lies with me. And I've got to find a way to fix it. And I will. I will fix it. Here's the issue, though. You know, we are the story of missed opportunities. We are. It's been all season. And, you know, you think you have the fix in. You think you have ways to square things away. And then for whatever reason, it doesn't get executed. So, you know, you got to make some decisions, and that's what I'm doing. I'm in the process of doing that now. You got to make some decisions that will get it fixed. And we got a talented young quarterback. We got a talented wide receiver group. Got a talented running back group. And there's no reason we should control the ball for 35 minutes and only score 7 points. So we've got to find a way to get that fixed. And I got some ideas. And we're going to put those into play here pretty quick.
Are those, when you talk about the decisions, are we talking personnel decisions? Are we talking ways to get these guys the information, to get the plays, ways to change or work on in practice?
All the above. And you know, one of the things that you hear me, you guys, we talk about every week about putting guys in position to be successful. That's the responsibility of the coach. And so, you know, what you have to do, each guy learns in different. Everybody has a unique way of learning, a unique way of executing. And you have to tailor your message to each one of those guys individually. And so, you know, teach them fundamentals and teach them how to navigate this world of Division I football. And that's what we're going to have to do a better job of.
James Spady, Alabama A&M head football coach, joining the show. Now that we are beginning to get a little bit closer here, how do you think this early signing day is going to impact football teams and, I guess, athletic departments in general? So sort of a 1,000-foot view of how do you think this will, in a different way than we're used to in previous years, affect college football?
I'm just as curious about that as you are right now. I mean, one of the things that we talk about as coaches – on the FCS level, for instance, not as sure that it's as big a benefit for us as it is for the big boys. For instance, if I'm recruiting a young man who's somewhere between FCS and FBS, and, you know, he's counting on Auburn to sign him, and then in the early signing period, Auburn signs a kid that's actually of the same position, then now I can go back into that young man and say, hey, listen, you're probably not going to go to Auburn. They just signed Cole Kublik, and he plays the same position as you. So there's a good chance, man, that you might want to take a real serious look at us. From that standpoint, I think it's, you know, it could be a benefit to us because we get to identify who they are. And but beyond that, I'm not sure. We don't have the resources to bring guys in during the course of the season. And that's what you would have to do if you're going to sign these kids in December. You'd have to bring them in for official visits throughout the course of the season and some, you know, earlier than that maybe. And so I don't know that financially we're able to get in that market.
Do you think it will benefit you guys more on the back end, on the later signing day? As in, maybe some kids who are going to skip the early signing day and are waiting don't get those opportunities like you mentioned?
Correct. And, I mean, that's kind of what I think is going to be the benefit for us. We're, A, going to be able to identify the guys that, you know, because I'm recruiting the same kids they're recruiting. The difference is the kids, you know, they grew up watching Alabama. They grew up watching Auburn. And those are the ideas that they have when they come out of high school. And so, you know, for me, you know, if there's a guy like that, you know, and I can wait and see whether or not he's still available rather than push a bunch of resources at him and then wind up losing out on him because he wants to go to Auburn and he's wanted to go there all his life, and, you know, on down the line. So it may be that we would be able to at least clarify and you know, give ourselves a list that's more realistic right before the February signing day.
All right, coming up, you guys are looking at Kentucky State University. What can you tell us about the Thoroughbreds?
Division II program, you know, and the one thing that I always kind of caution folks, don't get into that Division I, Division II, FBS, FCS nonsense. I think that's, you know, we're supposed to be deeper than Kentucky State, just like Auburn's supposed to be deeper than us. But, you know, on any given Saturday, anybody has the right to make plays, and they have the ability to maybe beat you. And so we're cautioning our kids. Don't get caught up in that nonsense. You better prepare for these guys because they're going to come in here and think that they can beat you. And so it's going to be up to us to execute and, you know, bring a level of play that they can't match.
Coach, we appreciate the time, as always. Look forward to catching up with you next week.
I appreciate you guys. Always enjoy our talks, man.
Thank you. James Spady, head coach of the Alabama A&M Bulldogs, joining us there on the phones. So a bit of a rough year for A&M, but Coach Spady, the thing that I appreciate about him and that I like about him, Marcus Shea, is he owns it and he takes it. He takes responsibility. And he does not try and deflect any of the issues. And we hear a lot of head coaches at a lot of different levels of college football do that on a regular basis. Talk about injuries, talk about officiating, talk about guys leaving the team. And there are never any excuses from James Spady.
No, and that's what you would hope for as a leader of your team. But, you know, it's a young squad, you know, talking about quarterback issues too. I mean, I think there was an interception thrown on a fade. I mean, they had a couple chances to score against Jackson State. I think there was an interception thrown on a fade, which almost never happens because you're supposed to throw that high and outside, so to speak. You're supposed to throw that basically where it's incomplete or your guy has it, and it was thrown a little inside. So there was an interception there and didn't come away with points. They missed a field goal in that game, and they lost in the last second field goal. So, you know, disappointing loss, mistakes that can be cleaned up for going forward, and they'll have a chance to start off with the Thoroughbreds, which I believe Montevallo played at one point in the old baseball.
I was going to say, I didn't think Montevallo had football.
No. But, you know, what happens is, like, starting in February, these northern teams where it's really, really cold will start coming to teams in Alabama and Florida to start playing February games. Get the season underway because it's usually way too cold up there to start hosting games. So, like, well, let's get our season underway on the road. So they'll go to places like Montevallo, UAH, Tampa, you know, stuff like that, where it's a little bit warmer. Still might be really chilly, but at least there's not snow and the ground's not hard as a rock.
So when we come back, we're going to make up our visit from yesterday with former Auburn quarterback Ben Lear. This is one that a lot of people were anticipating yesterday, were excited about yesterday. Ben had a conference call, couldn't join us, took up most of the show, and he's been kind enough to rejoin us today. Want to get his thoughts on Auburn, Georgia, his thoughts moving forward for this Auburn team, why he thought it took place, and obviously he'll have some emotion here as this is his big game of the year and biggest game of the year, and one that I know he'll be excited to discuss. We'll do that.
Now why me you crank that song? Now what? Soldier boy, I've been it. Oh, why me crank it? Why me?
Welcome back in. Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Up. Making up from a missed visit yesterday, former Auburn quarterback Ben Leard with us now. Ben, how you feeling this Tuesday morning?
Cube One, I feel great, buddy.
What was the atmosphere?
Apologize for leaving you hanging yesterday.
Don't worry about that. What was the atmosphere like inside Jordan-Hare Stadium, or if you listen to Ali LaForce, Jordan-Hare Stadium, Saturday afternoon?
Cole, it was insane, man. It hasn't been that electric since 2013. I mean, it was unbelievably loud. The crowd was just relentless on Jake Fromm and the Georgia football team with regards to that. They never let up. And truly, that was the 12th man to steal something away from A&M, but it was it definitely made a huge difference. You know, there were several times that Georgia was in third and long, and you knew that Jeff Holland and, you know, the guys were Nick Coe and defensive front were just teeing off and pinning their ears back, and the crowd really played a huge part in that role.
You look at this Auburn offense, what did they do, in your opinion, that allowed them to be so successful?
Well, I think a couple of things, and you touched on it you know, even yesterday, you know, in some of your analysis, they dominated the line of scrimmage. The offensive line at Auburn, you know, even from the standpoint of having to move some guys around, shuffle some guys around early, Golson especially, but they dominated the point of attack, and it really set the tone for the remainder of the game. And it carried over on the defensive side of the ball as well, and the defensive front continued to do what they have done all season. But, you know, offensively, the domination the offensive line had carried over into the running game with Kerryon having the spectacular game that he had. And then from a protection standpoint, with the exception of a couple of little blitzes here and there that ended up getting to Jarrett, but for the most part, the protection was phenomenal. They allowed Jarrett the ability to read the defense and make the throws that were necessary to be made to sustain drives and score touchdowns. I just think really the linchpin of that ball game, the linchpin of that offensive output was 100% solely predicated on the dominance on the offensive line.
Ben Leard, former Auburn quarterback, joining us now. I know you don't always pay as much attention to the defensive side of things, but I'm under the impression that this Auburn defensive line is the best in the SEC right now, and did a lot to prove it on Saturday afternoon. What's your opinion on how that group played?
I agree with you 100%, Cole. They are without a doubt. When you break it down by unit, right, when you break it down into segments with regards to the front four or the defensive front, the linebacking core, and then the secondary that Auburn puts on the field, you've got to prioritize that with regards to the guys on the front line. They are hands down the best defensive front in the SEC, and I don't think it's a stretch, Cole, and I hope you would agree with me. I don't think it's a stretch to say they're one of the tops in the country. They are dominant on the inside. They're dominant with regards to the interior defensive front. They get pushed. And then you've got the guys on the edges that do nothing but just absolutely get after it. I mean, they are tireless with regards to their pursuit of the quarterback and the football. And they are fun to watch, man. I mean, they are always in the game. They're always doing whatever it takes. They have a motor like no other. And really kind of reminds me of the guys, I mean, really, I hate to draw this comparison to a Georgia guy, but when you go back and look at somebody like David Pollack when he was at Georgia, Jeff Holland reminds me of Pollack from the standpoint of his attitude and his mentality and the fact that he never stops. He never slows down. Every play is 110%, and it's paying dividends at this point in the season leading into – obviously this Saturday against Louisiana Monroe, but then in a couple of weeks with what stands to be one of the most exciting Iron Bowls that has ever come to the Plains.
When you look at that game and how Auburn matches up, I know things can happen over the next week or two. Guys could be lost. Guys could be back. What do you see in how Auburn matches up with Alabama today?
Well, I think – you know, if you look at it with regards to Auburn's offense versus Alabama's defense, I think they match up extremely well. Auburn will fortunately be the beneficiary of Alabama really limping into that game, especially from the linebacker position. They've just been decimated by injuries, even in the secondary. Minka Fitzpatrick, who is the best player in the country, I believe, and I think you would agree, and the fact that he's been hampered a little bit with some knee injury, with some hamstring injuries over the last couple of weeks, and that hurts them from a scheme perspective at times. But, you know, so offensively, I think the matchup is there that favors Auburn because of the injury bug that has bitten Alabama's defense and especially the linebacking core. But on the offensive side of the ball, I think Alabama is really a huge threat, more so to me than Georgia, simply because of Jalen Hurts. You're going to see a different mentality, I believe, maybe a different approach from the defensive front and the front seven of Auburn, because they do have to be concerned with the running ability of Jalen Hurts. They do have to do some sort of spy. They have to pay attention and respect his ability to convert third and long with his feet and breaking some tackles in the pocket, stepping up in the pocket and making plays with his legs. So they're not going to be able to truly pin their ears back and come after him the way they did Jake Fromm, because Fromm just was not a threat to run the football. He was throw or get sacked, one or the other. And Jalen is a guy, is a talented, talented kid, has won a lot of football games, doesn't get flustered with pressure, doesn't get rattled with stress. He just plays the next play. And his the weaponry that he has available to him, not only from the exterior perspective with regards to the other skill positions that he has around him, but with regards to the quivers or the arrows that he has in his quiver with regards to his legs, his ability to throw the ball, his improvement he has made throwing the football, and then, of course, you know, being able to make decisions at the line of scrimmage. So, you know, I think you're not going to see as much of an aggressive personality from Auburn's defense in facing Alabama in 2 weeks, but I do think you're going to still see that hopefully the dominance that Auburn has possessed throughout the season.
What, in your opinion, what's the best way to defend a quarterback whose greatest virtue may be beating you with escapability, not just design runs, not just speed, not even the fact that they're a dual threat with, you know, quarterback powers and sweeps and options and things of that nature, but whose escapability may be his biggest asset?
Well, you know, you go back and look at it, and majority of the time, Jalen Hurts' escapability comes from, or the threat that he poses comes from his ability to step up into the pocket, kind of like that boomerang situation where he steps in the pocket and then bounces himself outside, whether it be right or left. And it's difficult to coach a defensive lineman because their mentality is so aggressive to get after the quarterback, play their responsibilities and sack, make a tackle, get after the football. You almost have to have them notch that down just a little bit and just contain. Don't create lanes. Don't create lanes with aggression. Make Jalen Hurts pick and choose. If he is to be able to escape, he needs to do it with a bow. He needs to do it with the rounded technique of running out of the pocket with depth from to the right or to the left, which really makes him gain more ground or get further and further away from the line of scrimmage, as opposed to attacking the line of scrimmage running straight ahead. But, you know, that's certainly not a technique that any defensive lineman ever had to take when they were playing me. But, you know, looking at what you would try to do, you obviously have to spy him. You have to put athlete on athlete and have a guy keep their eye on Jalen Hurts, which really creates problems in the secondary. But you almost have to go against everything that a defensive lineman has coached up until this point in his career to try and contain rather than create and allow gaps and voids in the defensive front with your aggression.
It's tough because if there's something that Alabama struggles with up front, it's been movement. And when you move guys and you stunt or you slant, then all of a sudden you're by design opening up some of those run lanes that you mentioned. So that balance has to be something that you carefully game plan for.
Well, and you know, you go back and look, and Cole, I know you can recall this because it was, you know, a lot of times back in the day, defensive linemen were a lot of times were reliant on the bull rush. And that bull rush does one of two things. It either gets you, it's mono and mono. It's one against one, but it maintains your position as a defensive lineman. You either run straight through that offensive lineman and run straight to the point of attack, or you maintain your ground, hopefully, unless you get pity roll. But that's the thing that you're saying with the standpoint of creating gaps, stunts, gains, things like that. You're exactly right. You're creating voids just with your technique, just with the play call. You're creating voids, and you have to be cognizant of those voids and fill them somehow. Find a way to fill those voids somehow, because Jalen Hurts is talented enough and is good enough of a quarterback to make you pay for those.
The passing concepts that are having success in this Auburn offense, are they different than what you've seen the past few years?
No, not really. You know, I don't think the concepts are any different because they're shots. You know, when you go back and look, let's take a look at the 40-yard touchdown pass that Jarrett Stidham threw to Darius Slayton. That was a deep shot. There was no intermediate. option there. It was Max Protect. They had a quote unquote fake screen off the left side to Davis that really froze the safeties and froze the opposite side defensive secondary of Georgia and allowed those two deep posts to isolate the corners and the safety. But that's what Gus's passing game is built on, is taking a shot, and if it's there, throw it up and have your guys make a play. If it's not, have your quarterback make a play. And I think that's been one of, from a passing game perspective, that's been one of the Achilles heels of a Gus Malzahn offense, that there is truly not any development off of the route tree. It's either A, B, or throw it away. A, B, or take a sack. A, B, or make a play with your legs. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is we realize that against LSU that there's really not a pro style or really not a full passing game that Auburn can rely on at this point or has been able to rely on within this offense to truly win a game, to truly drop back multiple times in a drive, take a five-step drop, read the quarters, read the corners, read the safeties, and go 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to drop down or to a check down route. Those things just aren't there within that offense. And at this point, knock on wood, it hasn't hurt them that bad. But if they face a defense that has the ability to absolutely shut down Auburn's running game, they're going to have to get more and more creative in the air.
Great stuff, Ben. Look forward to catching up next week.
You got it, Cube. Have a good week. War Eagle.
War Eagle. Former Auburn quarterback Ben Lear joining the show. We'll take a break. Back with more after this.